the dragons passing them over, they would rule. Trouble. The professor enters, and I stuff the confiscated leaflet into my backpack as I rise with the other two.
Three this year. That's got to be a record high.
Professor Sidney turns out to be possibly the oldest, tallest man I've ever seen. His hair a shock of white atop his long head. He barely looks at us as he enters and begins writing on the chalkboard with his back completely turned.
Norish, he says. That's what we're learning here. Language of the Norsians, of what was once Old Norcia and is now New Pythos. I'm Professor Sidney. If you're in the wrong room, leave now.
He speaks in dragon tongue. He has written Norish, Sidney, in the dragon tongue script with a shaking hand on the board. He turns around and his glare falls on me. I recognize the look of a professor being confronted with the unwelcome sight of a female student.
Tell me, do you board here? He asks.
Usually, the guardian uniform curbs this kind of blatant skepticism. But Sidney might not be able to make out my decorations in the dim light. No, I board nearby. Power rolls his eyes. For a moment, Sidney only rasps. Then he tells the chalkboard.
Went over to New Pythos when I was about your age, a fledgling linguist. Not the last triarchy, the one before, under Argus the First. We had good relations with the Hay Aurelians then. The local population, on the other hand.
Sidney waves a shaking hand.
The Norsians are a good people, but primitive. They worship their caste, anthropomorphize them, claim there used to be a nag and kraken and so on who walked among them, and they're clannish. Too busy fighting among themselves to do much else.
Sort of like the Highlands, Power prompts, flicking me a wink. I consider kicking the leg of Power's desk, but the first year is staring at me.
I lift an eyebrow at him and he flushes. Sidney still faces the board, nodding at it.
Very much like the Highlands. They were just sitting on all that ore until the Hay Aurelians got there and got them mining it. No native writing system. I had to transliterate it in the Kalish script myself. No textbook to learn it with, so I wrote my own. That's what we'll be using here. If everyone will turn to the introduction.
Power's good mood seems to grow as the class progresses, and he tests the far reaches of bigoted remarks he can mine from Sidney. He leaves the room with a triumphant smirk that sobers when we're alone in the corridor. It's even darker here than it was in the classroom.
You could tell him who you are, he points out.
We watch the first year scurry off, probably to tell his friends that he's in a class with two guardians and a professor who doesn't recognize them. Or you could stop egging him on.
But what would be the fun in that?
Power and I have always had different definitions of fun. But more than anything, Sidney's casual biases leave me ruminating. The Norsian underclass on New Pythos is so far from being the focus of our military strategy that even on the brink of a war, their language is still being taught by a senile scholar to a class of three. The casual dismissiveness of Sidney's waved hand to describe their culture, isn't that the same kind of disdain that led the Dragonborn to underestimate their own people the commoners who overthrew them? Power meant his reference to the Highlands as a joke at my expense. But it was more apt than he knew. I find an invitation to my own rapprochement with the first protector waiting for me when I return to the cloister after class. From Miranda Hayne, the Minister of Propaganda. I'm invited to have tea at the coach house tomorrow afternoon, before Dora's party. I consider, upon first studying the invitation, simply not going. But I recognise Miranda Hayne's handwriting. It was the handwriting that told me, on a note delivered before the First Rider tournament, but read after, "Go show them what you're made of." And she was one of the few adults whose integrity I depended on when I confronted Atreus on Pytho's keep. So the following afternoon, I go. Like the Guardians, Atreus occupies what were servants' quarters in the old regime, and his residence remains an austere little building attached to the inner palace. The coach house, so named because that is what it used to be. Atreus keeps a limited staff. His furnishings are sparse. The foyer that I'm invited to wait in is little larger than the office I keep in the cloister, and its only adornment is a tapestry from the Basilean Wars. Goliathans, a continental breed of dragon that dwarf those from the island nations of the Medean, loom as large as whales against a faded, embroidered sky, sparring with our storm scourges and dodging Damian harpooners. The Basilean Wars were the last to spread across the whole sea and all its courts.
Antigone, forgive me for keeping you waiting. Do come in.
Atreus himself welcomes me into his parlour. He and Miranda have taken seats on opposite sides of a small tea set. Miranda offers an encouraging smile as I ease into one of Atreus's straight-backed upholstered chairs. Atreus serves me tea himself. No servant is called.
"So," he says when I have it in hand, "book 24.
It takes me a moment to understand. He's talking about the Aurelian cycle and my unauthorized trip to return Julia's body. He doesn't sound displeased. His copy of the poem, familiar from when he taught classes with the Fourth Order last term, lies on the table between us. It has the Ministry standard stamp of banned material on its front. Atreus himself approved the ban of the Aurelian cycle for the sake of political stability, but that does not undo the fact that he loves the poem and knows it by heart.
Did it work?
I nod. I quoted the lines about safe passage. The Pythians understood and ensured our return. Atreus's smile contains mysteries of memory.
Brilliant.
Again, that strange warmth that came during the meeting with the War Council. Unwanted, the pleasure of his approval.
This man tried to kill your friend. Twice. As a leader, Atreus says, I think often about how important it is to recognize talent when I see it. To judge with an unbiased eye. After the last meeting with the War Council, I was left pondering how difficult that is. It is something Miranda and I have been discussing. How the biases of the old order have a way of carrying over, even with us. Even with the best intentions, we can sometimes see talent only where we've been trained to see it. And in other cases, not notice it where we aren't used to looking for it. Even when that talent shines brightly.
As I begin to understand, I feel my face move with emotions I don't want Atreus to see. I know what he's trying to do,
as transparently as if he had announced it. Lee is lost to him. He is now in search of a new ally. But I also know that Atreus is not a man to lie, nor are the sentiments he's expressing out of character. He seeks an ally, but the confessions he's offering are honest. And I've had too many professors like Sydney, too many meetings like the one with Holmes, being underestimated and overlooked, not to feel his words like water on parched earth. Lee. This man tried to kill Lee. For that, I would like to apologize, Antigone. You have proven yourself repeatedly to be everything I hoped for in a guardian, committed to the ideals of the revolution, unafraid to sacrifice for them, unafraid, in short, to do what it takes. Naturally, there have been moments of misunderstanding, as there often are between revolutionaries, as Miranda and I can attest from long years working together on this vision. There will always be times of disagreement. What I admire in how you have handled our disagreement was your commitment to justice. Your difference in interpretation from my own only showed me that you are doing what I hoped all along the Guardians would do. Think for themselves. Atreus inclines his head, smiling. I hope I can depend on you to continue to do so. There is something violent, almost ugly, in the satisfying of a craving you've buried so deep in yourself you forgot it was there. I had that feeling once, staring at a note scrawled by Miranda Hain in the aftermath of a match. I have it again now. As Atreus pours out affirmation I so long ago stopped expecting, I forgot I ever once hoped for it. Talent that shines brightly. Back in the cloister, before preparing for Dora's party, I draw a hot bath to clear my head. My hair, burned halfway off in the First Rider tournament but growing out, is still short enough to towel dry. I let myself back into the girls' dorm to unwrap Dora's parcel. The dress inside is black, silken, full length with a wide, high neck. I pull it over my shoulders and rummage in Alexa's dresser for her smuggled mirror and study my reflection. Dora chose well. The black sets off the color of my hair, and the neckline makes me look adult. You are everything we hoped a guardian could be. A knock sounds on the door. Come in. It's Lee, in ceremonial uniform, alone. His chin freshly shaven, his dark hair slicked back and combed. The gold trimming of his black mantle, of the decorations on his uniform, glow in the low light like so many stars. This is the style of dress Lee has always looked most at home in, like he could have stepped out of a tapestry of the old regime and into the new, ready to command in either one. His eyes leave mine and travel down, slowly. And then they snap back to my face. How does he manage to make me shiver with just a look? And then a shiver of guilt, like cold water trickling down my spine. What would he think? To know I spent the last hour reeling from compliments given by the man who betrayed him. Is it a betrayal of Lee? To stand straighter because of things the First Protector said? Are you ready to go over? Yeah, one second. I'm fumbling, elbows at my ears, to do up the last button of my dress. Lee closes the distance. His fingers take the button from mine.
I stand quite still, feeling his touch light on my neck, holding my breath, remembering. The button is fastened. His fingers trail upward and brush against the chain of my necklace. You still wear it? His voice is a murmur. I'm lightheaded from the mere brush of his fingertips. I always wear it. My mother's necklace. The one he found, buried in the dirt by my home, when we went there together and I told him everything. The one he clasped around my neck when last his fingers traced the nape of my neck. That Lee listened so well, and spoke so little, and sat so close, ready to stand there with me through it all. I turn to face him. His fingers are hooked under the chain of the necklace, drawing it out, laying the pendant against the silk of the dress with strange reverence. And then a flick of grey, and he is looking at me. Looking at me like he sees me. The shutters opened. How was Cheapside Grammar? He asks. That was the last time we were alone, I realize. When he called our old school some grammar school in Cheapside, with his back turned. My throat catches. It was all right. Mistress Dunbar's still there. She asked about you. You two were inseparable, she said. It brought back a host of memories that are almost too painful now to think on. Lee sitting next to me in class, next to me at meals, glaring at anyone who so much as glanced in my direction, like a dog with hackles raised. Lee sitting across from me, rapt, while I read the people's paper to him, back to back, in the corner of a dusty play yard. Inseparable. Lee nods, and standing so close to him I can hear him swallow. When he speaks, his voice is hoarse.
I was wondering if you wanted to ride with me to the party, since we're supposed to bring dragons.
I can't hide the confusion from my voice. Ride with you? Lee reaches up to rub at the crease between his brows and squints at his own hand.
Side saddle to protect the dress? That's how my parents did it.
I can count on one hand the number of times Lee has mentioned his family to me. For so many years, his old life wasn't acknowledged. And in the last months, when it could be, there was still the shadow of who Leon was and what he did, hanging over us both. His parents. A mother who wore long gowns and climbed onto the saddle beside her husband. A dragon lord and his lady. Lee's mother and father, whom he's missed just as I've missed mine. All of this in a few words, like a delicate flower plucked from the earth and offered, for me to cradle in my hands or crush under my heel as I choose. I have to lift on tiptoes to kiss him on the cheek. Of course.
Lee. I debated whether to go to Dora's party from the moment I received the invitation. Debated it even as I pulled on the ceremonial uniform I haven't worn since the Lycian ball, remembering the difference. Then, a regime whose seal I was proud to bear. Whereas today, I've half a mind when I knock on the door to the girls' dorm to tell Annie I won't go. But then I see her. I've begun to spend so much time not feeling like myself that I notice when I do. Joking with Cor about going hungry, moonlighting in Cheapside, getting called a hero by a classmate with a playful turn to her voice, those things pull me back. Humour, laughter, defiance. But so does beauty. The cloud-filled sky from Palor's back, the words of the Aurelian cycle, pulled from the shelves of the cloister library in the dead of night, rolling beneath my fingers like a living thing. The sight of Annie, sheathed in black silk, her hair a wreath of brown fire. I've spent years making myself not notice how she looks in a flame suit, also black, also form-fitting. But this gown asks to be looked at, to show her as a woman, and for the brief glance I let myself take of her hips tapering to waist, of the nubs of her collarbones peeking beneath a high neckline. I remember the miracle of it, that this vision of a girl once stood on tiptoe to fit her lips to mine. That when she felt my hands on her waist, she only kissed me harder. And as with the sound of Kor's laughter, as with the sight of the sky from Dragonback, I feel the blackness part from my mind like a breaking cloud. So suddenly, so completely, that I can't imagine it ever having been. Atreus, Dora, this regime or that, what do they matter in the face of such beauty? Of Annie's blush flooding freckled cheeks as she smiles up at me. We're talking, words I hardly hear, as she lets me button up her dress and touch her mother's necklace. And then I say something profoundly stupid, mention parents I shouldn't, and instead of it falling apart as I half expect, Annie kisses me on the cheek with such tenderness that I think there, right there, I will melt to the ground from dizzy relief. And then the miracle keeps going, and 15 minutes later I'm explaining to her how to ride side saddle as I hold Palor by the reins, offering laced hands to help her onto his back. Palor is alert, his horns perked, his tail slightly lifted. But he knows Annie, who smells of Ayla. In another life, my father would have taught me how to do this. But he's not here. And so I have to guess. Guess that I should let it spill over just a little into Palor, the feelings of muddled happiness at the sight of Annie. The instinct that feels a little wrong, but she never need know, of protectiveness, of possessiveness, at the sight of her standing at my dragon's side like this, so that he knows the loyalty he feels to me should encompass her. What if he throws? He won't. She looks into my eyes, and the cave's torchlight is enough for her to see the dilated pupils, to know that I can vouch for Palor with the certainty that comes from spillover. She plants a heeled shoe into my laced fingers, the opposite foot from the one she would place into a stirrup, and I hoist her onto his saddle. He sits, still and careful, as if he were cradling a hatchling. I can hear her breathing, and, with the heightened senses of the spillover, smell her. Just a faint scent of fear. Lee? For a moment I look up at them and remember my parents, and try to memorize it, Annie on Palor's back. Black satin perched on silver scales, flaming hair in the dark, the halo of her face turned toward mine, trusting. My parents were always in high spirits on occasions when she joined him on Alethea. But only now do I understand the tenderness of the moment. How looking up at them together, I feel I'm looking at something perfect. I hook a boot into the stirrup and climb onto Palor's back behind her. She eases against me, fitting the lines of her body into mine, and I wrap an arm around her waist under her mantle. Amid the feelings that are mine and the feelings that are Palor's, I murmur the reminder in her ear and my voice comes out hoarse. Summon Ayla. Ayla comes to our wing as we glide out the firemouth, and as we rise, Annie inhales so sharply, I can feel her jutting hip bones quiver beneath my palm. A toll of the rationing that the uniform hides, and it brings a knee-jerk alarm and a host of memories of the orphanage. where I learned to hate hunger, but to hate the sight of her hunger more. Learned that sometimes it was more important to watch someone else eat. The best parts of myself I found with Annie. You all right? Annie's fingers are clutching my arm so tightly I'm losing feeling in it. I think I prefer riding my own dragon. I laugh aloud. Annie twists in surprise. What? That's just not a comparison any of the women in my family could have made. For the second time today, talking about my family like an idiot. And for the second time today, Annie doesn't shrink from it. Her fingers trace my sleeve to my hand and squeeze it, and I tighten my grip on her too narrow waist. We've leveled with Pytho's keep. The sun is setting. The stratus that mantled the sky shredding in the fiery light. The river is a ribbon of gold below. The rooftops of the Janiculum and the lower neighborhoods gleaming. The sun is low enough on the horizon that Palor's and Aela's wings are lit from below, glowing in the dying light. Annie takes another shuddering breath, and I know this gasp is not of fear, but of sudden, breathless delight. Her gaze flows north, a wash of red turning violet, turning deepest blue, where the horizon meets the sea. I keep scanning for them to come back. Chrissa and Duck. But we're the only pair of dragons in sight. I can think of no answer to give that wouldn't be hollow comfort. Tonight, tomorrow morning at the outset, is their projected return. And the sleepless nights we've stared at the ceiling wondering if they don't bear discussing. Game for a dive? Annie nods, her grip tightening on my arm, and we lean close to Palor's back as he folds his wings and we plummet. The lower bank rises up to meet us, Scholars Row with the War College on one side and the Lyceum on the other. And then we are leveling out, spiraling gently, to a light on the drive in front of the Lyceum Club, inside the university walls. This time of year, the ivy climbing the limestone has turned a fading red. I slide off Palor's back, help Annie down, and make arrangements with the porter with a barely suppressed sense of satisfaction because this, the carriages rolling in at dusk, the glittering gowns beneath mantles, the laughter from steaming breath, is a world I remember watching from child height. But tonight, with a dragon at my side and Annie on my arm, I understand at last the brilliance of my father's smile when the knight was young. We're happy to install them ourselves, Bart. It's no problem, I tell the porter. The Lyceum was built by Atreus after the revolution, and its stone stables were designed to house guardians' dragons. Tonight is the first time they'll be employed for the purpose. Eater and Morana already occupy two of the largest stalls built for storm scourges. Aela and Palor dart into a third stall together and begin tracking circles at its far end, warming the stone with small bursts of fire, pleased by the snug darkness. Her hand on the gate, Annie pauses, studying the two of them making their nest, her face softening. Palor and Aela barely notice when we close and latch their stall, and as we enter the club, Annie tucks her arm into mine once more. The valet directs us to the upper level where the fate of the Fourth Order will be held. On the landing, I glance at the tapestry decorating the landing of the second floor, and then I look again. It once belonged to my father.
Annie. Still flushed from the flight, Aela and Palor's contentment singing in my blood, it takes me a moment to realize why Lee has frozen on the landing of the Lyceum Club's second floor. Feet from the party we're about to attend. The sounds of laughter and a low murmur of conversation seep from a room a little farther down the hall. Then I look at the dimly lit tapestry on the panelled wall. It depicts the western cliffs off the Callipolin Highlands, and on one of the highest ledges, a manor overlooking the sea. Lee reaches up, stretches the tips of his fingers, and touches them to the threads of the lowest weave.
How?
His eyes narrow on the small metal plaque below it. Far Hall, Drakarchic seat of the Far Highlands. Storm Scourge provenance, on loan from the Mithridates estate. As I understand, I feel sick. This is a landscape of Lee's family's manor, Lee's family's art. And now it's hanging forgotten on a landing of the Lyceum Club.
Dora owns this?
Lee breathes. After the revolution, the new regime's auctions of dragonborn possessions went on for months. What wasn't sold was gifted to the faithful, and what was left entered the revolutionary collection. It's one thing to know that, but quite another to look up at one of these artifacts beside the boy it used to belong to, and watch him blink over and over as he wills himself to understand. The fact that it's an accident that Lee is encountering this tapestry, because Dora likely lent spare decorations to the club without a second thought, only makes it worse.
This used to hang in my father's study.
He sounds lost. I have the sudden urge to step between him and the landscape. Pity mingles with something else, something closer to dread. We were doing so well. He was doing so well. Until he found this stupid tapestry. I tell him as softly as I dare, the thing I know he already knows. A lot of things probably belong to Dora now, Lee. The latent nerves I've been feeling at the thought of what comes next. The golds I've never been good at impressing. The exposure I share with Lee's identity now known falls away as I realize I'm not the one most in need of courage tonight. I might not be eager to set foot inside a room where my low birth will be held against me. But at least I don't have to look at the home they took from me on my way in the door. We need to recenter. The tapestry isn't the point. The patrician's insensitivity isn't the point. The point isn't this corridor. The point is the room on the other side of that door and where it will lead. I take a step sideways so that Lee must turn his back on his family's manor to look at me. Lee, Dora Mithridates showed interest in us after the jewel. You particularly. She spoke about our futures, which means the protectorship. Succession. Her friends are in there. This is an informal audition. In other words, stay with me. But I can see the tension seizing his shoulders.
And Atreus?
He's been invited too.
Annie, I'm not sure I want...
No, this isn't something I'll hear. Nor is it something at the end of the day that I believe. I think of how Atreus said it. The role of a leader is to recognize talent when you see it. Lee's charisma, his effortless charm, the ease with which he walks into power. These things used to threaten me. But the difference between an advantage and a weakness is your dragon's relative position to the ground. Now I'm the leader. First rider, commander of the aerial fleet, and guardian of this city, sworn to guide it to justice. Lee is a rider in my core. And just as Atreus recognized talent in me, now it's my role to recognize talent in him. I reach up to cup his face in both my hands, feeling the sharp chin, the high cheekbones of a Storm Scourge face. You want to lead this city. You've wanted to lead it ever since it was taken from you. You want Atreus replaced? Be the one who replaces him. This is your chance. Lee's lips have parted with surprise. You want that? I hear what he means by that. Me. All the history I bear. All the reasons I have for wanting someone, anyone other than this Dragon Lord's son to lead my city. How did Atreus say it? A leader should judge with an unbiased eye. Lee's strengths don't have to threaten me anymore. They're an asset. The realization leaves me with a rush of exhilaration, like I'm on dragonback leaving the ground. I want that. Lee reaches out to take both my hands in his. Together, he says, his voice shaking. We do this together. Together, I repeat. Once, years ago, we walked hand in hand through a door, into a choosing ceremony that I did not think I wanted, into a room where Ayla found me and Palor found Lee, and our new lives began. Tonight, we walk hand in hand through a doorway again.
8. Punishment forfeit. Griff. The secret of the Kallipolan spies eats at me. First, I wonder at myself for not sharing it. They'll be seen by someone else. When they aren't, I begin to wonder if I saw them at all. But I know I did. And even if there are no laws for this, there doesn't have to be for me to know that I committed treason by omission. That I continue to commit it by omission. That I endanger everyone I know and love by saying nothing about Kallipolan spies from the south. They're here to scout, which means they'll return to bombard. And I know where those fires will catch fastest. On Norsian homes, with our thatch roofs and wooden frames. So why don't I speak? 2 days after the melee, Ixion receives his reply from Vask. Borne to him in the first Basileian trade ships to dock in our harbour since the Median League embargoed. Freyda sent 3 galleys, stocked in grains and spices to trade for silver and tin from our mines. She also invites Ixion to visit. I help him pack, welcoming the news that I'll have a few days rid of him. The morning Ixion departs, I'm finishing up breakfast when a knock sounds on our front door, in a tone I'm unfamiliar with. Soft, uncertain, not the hammer of a friend or guard. Granda looks up from the tea he's nursing with still fogged eyes. Garrett and Becca stop their arguing to look up, and Aga straightens at once, reaching for her widow's scarf. I'll get it, I tell her. At the door, in the misty morning light, stands Dilo. The sight of his blue mantle on our front step, in an alleyway of lean-tos, is incongruous. He's never come to my home before. Julia has, more than once, I think for the novelty of it. Ixion as well, when we were children, to tell the other Dragonborn about it later. But neither of these reasons suits Dilo. My lord? Dilo shifts weight. You probably know Ixion's on a diplomatic trip to Basilia. You're in my service while he's away. That doesn't explain why he's standing on my stoop. The news could just as easily have been delivered when I arrived at the Citadel. Dilo looks past me. Good morning, Aga. Aga smiles and curtsies. Hello, Lord Dilo. And then she looks from him to me, that smile spreading, and the delight of it makes me scowl at her. What? Aga turns back to Dilo. Do you want to come in for tea? This was what she served Julia. Dilo looks from her to me and says, Oh, it's fine, I don't want to impose. Julia always accepted the invitation without question. Aga's brow furrows at his hesitation. It wouldn't impose. I'm not so sure, but there's no way to argue with that, which Dilo seems to realize as well as I. Garrett and Becca watch with wide eyes from a crouch on the floor, quiet the way we've taught them to be in the presence of Dragonborn company. D'Lo ducks under our doorframe. He bows to Granda. Good morning, Grandfather. Granda creaks to his feet and bows jerkily. Please be seated, D'Lo murmurs. Are these your children? He asks Aga, with a smile at my crouching niece and nephew. She nods, swelling a bit with pride as she gestures to each. Becca and Garrett. D'Lo greets them and they chorus a greeting in return. I was sorry to hear of Eamon's passing, D'Lo tells Aga. Aga's face flickers at his naming, and she ducks her head in another curtsy, fingers pushing stray strands under her black scarf. You are kind to remember on it, my lord. I offer D'Lo a seat at the table while Aga takes the kettle off the fire and remain standing myself. For my family, tea means hot water. I don't think Aga even realizes that D'Lo is expecting something more when he lifts his mug to his lips and drinks. His brow furrows a fraction, but otherwise he shows no sign of surprise. Biscuit? Aga asks, which means bread. No, thank you, D'Lo says. Julia always helped herself, a politeness that thrilled Aga even as it left me wondering what we would have left to eat later. But D'Lo is looking around the house, measuring. I can tell he's checking for something, but for what, I can't tell. His eyes focus on Aga as she covers a small cough in her sleeve. And then he speaks to me in dragon tongue. What were the medicines, he asks, that Julia provided for her? I'd never told D'Lo she provided medicines, and I doubt Julia did either. She hardly thought of them as she gave them to me, even to the point that I was forced, more than once, to remind her. If Julia noticed my shame in such moments, it only amused her. Julia has wandered in and out of my dreams since her death, laughing, teasing, just out of reach. Other times she's within reach, but the things she holds aren't. Somehow, despite never being told this was the arrangement, D'Lo guessed. I tell him the herbs curtly, also in dragon tongue, and D'Lo nods. Granda twists round to look at me, uncomprehending and startled. I've never spoken dragon tongue in front of him before. Becca suppresses a giggle at the strange sounds. I'll make sure you get more, D'Lo says. I dip my head in a jerking bow. D'Lo frowns and flicks his wrist. I straighten. Was there anything else she provided for your family? I note the ways he has padded this moment, in front of my family, but in a language they won't understand, so that I feel compelled to confess needs that pride would otherwise keep silent. Food, when she thought of it. D'Lo drinks deeply from his hot water. His glance goes to the corner where shoes are piled. He nods at the pair whose toes are entirely gone. Whose are those? Garrett's. D'Lo nods, his gaze turning to Garrett, narrowing as he assesses his feet, as if memorizing their size. I'll look into it. Aga is glancing between us, an expression of uncertainty bordering fear at the dragon tongue, and D'Lo smiles at her to reassure her, a warmth that she responds to like sunlight. He rises and returns to Norish, accentless and crisp, handing her back his empty mug. Thank you for the tea, Aga. Griff, shall we? Aga's knowing smile follows me out of the house, like I've just accidentally let her in on a secret. Which is stupid, because it's no secret D'Lo's... D'Lo's what? Kind, thoughtful, and charming. Not smirking at my family's hot water for tea, like Julia did. Offering to help but no prompting on my part. And if I'm not mistaken, a little tongue-tied himself now that we're crossing Conqueror's Mound together on our way up to the Citadel. He is walking unnaturally fast, long legs taking long strides. I'm fairly trotting to keep up with him. My lord, if there's anything I can do to repay... It's like the words set off a tripwire. Thoughts of Julia, a sudden lurch in my stomach and heat in my face. What do I get in return, Griff? Absolutely not, D'Lo says. A strange relief, a strange disappointment, a question I consider asking with mischief unfit for the moment. Absolutely not what? That odd silence that happens when I arm him has started to pulse between us, but this time D'Lo's the one who fills it. His voice is raised oddly. He squints up at the gate we're approaching. With the Dragon Lord and company, we enter through the Lord's Gate. I was glad to see your sister in such good health, and her children. They've grown. I swallow that thick tongue and answer, little troublemakers these days. Really? Worse than we were? At my bark of laughter, D'Lo cracks a rare smile. I'm less surprised when we enter the muddy main yard, and today's strange good luck runs dry. Roxana Hay Aurelian waits for us, her long auburn hair loose and unbraided, her arms crossed over her blood-red mantle. She unfolds one of them to point at me. He should be dropped, she tells D'Lo. I stop dead. Surely, I think, they couldn't know I saw Kallipolin riders and kept silent. There's no way to prove it. D'Lo tilts his head. Hello to you too, Roxana. Roxana beckons, and I realize where she's leading us with a plummeting stomach. To the training pen at the edge of the few fields contained within Citadel walls, reserved for target practice. D'Lo follows. With misgiving, I do too, although I already can guess what we're about to find and have no wish to see it. Inside the pen, a Norsian peasant is darting back and forth across the charred ground as he attempts to evade the dragon bearing down on him. The Citadel Guard, all men of Clan Thornrose, are stationed on the edges of the yard. They're usually happy to do the Hay Aurelian's dirty business, but today even they look a bit squeamish. Rode stands outside the pen with an expression of detached fascination. Bran and Fiona, the two squires who serve Rode and Roxana, stand at attention by the gate, their faces quite blank. It's always considered a bonus when the humble riders get to watch this kind of demonstration. Rhodes Aurelian is named Ryla. She's been doused to prolong the process. As we approach, she grows tired of firing ash and pounces instead. The man screams as he topples. I recognize him. Shaynan of Clan Kraken, a miner from Aemon's old crew whose children Aga sometimes mines during the day. Apparently, Rode tells D'Lo, some of the clans have been talking about Antigone. Ryla flips Shaynan over like a rag doll. Fiona's grip on the side of the fence tightens. When we were younger, the prospect of Rode becoming Great Lord after Rhadamanthus wasn't one I thought much about. Ixion was the cruel one. Rode was just his idiot friend. But in recent years, in moments like this, I find the idea of a great lord of New Pythos with a dragon at his disposal enough to chill my blood. Rode doesn't have to share Ixion's love of hurting people to be perfectly good at it. We suffered enough under the Hay Aurelians when they'd run out of dragons, but with the next generation on dragonback again. D'Lo says, your father wouldn't like this, Rode. Are you planning to tell him? D'Lo is silent. Rode continues to study Shaynan, rubbing the stubble of his paltry moustache. You know, Ixion has a point. It is satisfying. Bran's voice bursts out from behind us. My lord, do you not think he's had enough? Rode rounds on him with a lifted wrist and Bran's mouth closes. Fiona's hands are fists at her sides, her eyes squinting at the ground, averted from the sight of Shaynan in the pen. D'Lo looks from the humble riders to Ryla mauling Shaynan. He takes a step closer to Rode. Ixion isn't here, he says, his voice lowering as it intensifies. And if that peasant dies, you'll have to pay his family the man price. Rhadamanthus is notoriously strict with Rhodes' allowance. Rhodes sighs, lifts an arm. Ryla disengages her fangs from Shaynan's arms with a low whine. Bran hovers by the gate.
My lord, please.
Rhodes waves permission with an uncaring arm, and Bran bursts through the gate to go to Shaynan. He skirts Ryla as she sniffs him with interest and hoists Shaynan to his feet. I study the dragon, wondering just how much trouble she'll be in the lairs later. This kind of thing riles the dragons, makes them more inclined to try something on their keepers. I've got more than a few burns from Ryla, and I don't look forward to adding more. Rhodes turns his back on the pen and his tone becomes businesslike. This one, he jabs a thumb at Shaynan, was overheard talking about a peasant first rider who's able to sing dragon tongue poetry like she's dragonborn herself. We were wondering where he might have heard about that. Griff. My name comes at the end of this, like a lash. I told the story of Antigone exactly once, to Aga on our stoop the night Julia's body was returned. But Becca must have overheard us. And if she told the other children Aga minds, they would have repeated the story to their parents. Fiona's head lifts at the sound of my name, her eyes widening. Dilo watches Bran guiding Shaynan from the pen with a frown, then turns to me. Griff, did you talk about our rendezvous with the Kallipolans? In town? Roxana scoffs, like he'll confess. Yes, I did, my lord. Dilo sags. I can feel a buzzing in my ears. Nothing they can threaten me with frightens me as much as the possibility that if I don't confess, they'll trace their interrogation of this gossip back to Aga and the little ones. It's sheer luck that they haven't already. I didn't mean anything by it, I add. Just thought it was a good story. Roxana recovers first. Dropped, she repeats. Worked for Madlina. It'll work for Griff. Don't be ridiculous, Dilo snaps. The Pythian fleet can't afford to drop Griff Garrison. The way he says it, Griff Garrison sounds like an armored warship. Rhodes is studying me, that same idle curiosity. He could take a turn in the pen. From the way Dilo frowns, I realize even he doesn't seem to be able to think of a counter-argument to that. I went in the pen once before. It's not an experience I'd like to repeat. I stare back at Rhodes, willing my face blank. And that's when the alarm bells go off. The dragonborn jump, Bran and Fiona freeze where they stand, Shaynan keeps swaying. That's a sighting, I realize. The Kallipolan spies, spotted at last. I know what it is, Garrison, Rhodes snaps. It's the first alarm bell New Pythos has ever sounded, not in drill. But as we set off at a jog into the citadel for the armories, I feel not fear, but anticipation. I remember those two shimmering skyfish darting into the cloud cover behind Kraken. Easy pickings. I think of the fang and talon marks that left tracks across Shaynan's body, the way it will feel to have the same wounds soon enough, and some suicidal brazenness overcomes me. How about a wager, Lord Rhodes? We've reached a fork in colonnades that will take Rhodes and Roxana to the Aurelian Armory with Bran and Fiona. Dilo and I to the skyfish. Rhodes whips around, his eyes wide with surprise at my impertinence, but I'm grinning. Behind their backs, Bran rolls his eyes at Fiona. My punishment forfeit, I propose, if I bring down a Kallipolan rider today. Dilo lets out a wild laugh at my nerve, and even Rhodes' tense face purses as if about to crack with a smile. I'll consider it, he says.
9. The Fate of the Fourth Order. Lee. The last time I shared the company of the patricians turned golds who brought down the triarchy, They didn't know who I was. I was only that slum orphan who looked so conveniently like a storm scourge and danced exceptionally well. Tonight, at Dora's party, they know different. And thanks to a tapestry of Farhall hanging on the landing on the way in the door, I'm not about to forget who they are, either. These are the people who got rich off the revolution, who bid on my family's things after cheering their murders. But it's still freeing not to hide anymore. And tonight, at least, unlike the Lycian ball when we debuted in Gold Society, the Annie on my arm isn't pushing me away at mention of a Storm Scourge resemblance. This one knows exactly who I am, and just told me she believes I'm worthy of this city anyway. A year ago, I wouldn't have been able to imagine it. Whether or not I agree with her, either that I'm worthy of this city, or that I even want it, is another question. When we enter, Annie's arm tucked in mine, Dora Mithridates glides over, kisses Annie on the cheek with surprising familiarity, and then lays a cool hand, glittering with jewels, on my arm. "Thank you so much for joining us, Leo." She uses the name I gave up and speaks in dragon tongue. I answer in it. "Thank you for taking such good care of my father's tapestries. Please, call me Lee." For a moment, Dora blinks slowly, like a frog eyeing a fly, while Annie's arm stiffens in mine. And then Dora smiles. "The tapestry on the landing! I'd forgotten about that. Remind me, another night, that we have related business to discuss." She taps the glass in her hand with a ring on her finger, and the note that sings through the room silences it. A hand against my back, presenting me to the onlooking golds, Dora lifts her voice. It carries easily in the high-ceilinged room, despite the padding of regulation blackout curtains over the windows. "Ladies and gentlemen of the Janiculum, join me in welcoming Antigone Sor Aela and Lee Sor Palor to our little fete. And forgive me for accompanying their welcome with a small announcement. Those of you who know me know my impatience with gossip." There are peals of laughter. "So allow me to broach the subject that has been consuming all our curiosity. Yes, Lee Sor Palor is also Leo Stormscourge, Leon's only surviving son. Yes, that is the same Leon mentioned in Antigone Sor Aela's biographical information. Yes, Leo, forgive me, Lee, has renounced the old order and proven it in a duel to the death with Kin. I'm sure Lee and Antigone are both eager to discuss their private lives in even more intimate detail with all of you for the remainder of the evening. And do not neglect Power Sur Eta and Cor Sur Morana, also present for your inspection. So allow me to hinder you no further from your prying, except to lift my glass and toast these very brave young people who have made the ideals of this revolution their life's work." By the time Dora's finished, Annie is blushing to the roots of her hair. Across the floor, Cor sits frozen in a booth where he nurses a drink alone. And Power, surrounded by his usual gaggle of gold girls, runs a hand over his stubbly head as he feels sudden eyes on him. Dora adds in a throaty whisper to me and Annie as the toast goes up,
"You'll forgive my haste. I wanted to get that one in before the Protector arrives. Are you ready to prance?"
I was expecting to meet Dora Mithridates feeling murderous after that tapestry. Instead, her acerbic sense of humour leaves me strangely disarmed. She leads us into the nearest circle of conversation without waiting for our answer, and as she predicted, the prying starts. They ask if I was present in the city for the revolution, which sounds innocuous enough, but really is a question about Palace Day, is asking if I was there, which seems to come from a place somewhere between morbid curiosity and guilt. Annie's warm hand remains on my arm, tightening ever so slightly as I answer with a smile I've trapped on my face. I hear myself say, "I was there for the whole thing." They ask if Annie and I knew each other in the Highlands. They ask if Annie knew who I was in the orphanage. Annie and I take turns answering like we're partners in a joint attack drill. Annie makes jokes, jokes, about Albans, the smile fixed on her face matching mine. I did start to notice he always had me pretending to be the maid servant. The golds titter, titillated. I swing round to look at Annie, too startled to be embarrassed. This is one of those memories, cloudy with distance and never since referred to, so uncomfortable, I'd hoped I imagined it. She holds my gaze with a blush on her cheeks and smirk on her lips. I could kiss her in front of all these asses. Dean Orthos, head of the Lyceum, is the first to ask directly about what transpired on Pytho's keep. His voice is lowered, the tassels of his academic cap swinging as he leans inward. "Is it true, my dear boy, that Atreus was not welcoming upon your return?" It doesn't take Annie's fingers squeezing my arm or Dora glaring at the dean to know the safest answer. I've gone on enough rounds with the Ministry of Propaganda to know when to keep my mouth shut. "I'm afraid I don't know what you mean." Dean Orthos grunts, dissatisfied. Dora lets out an airy laugh and pats his arm. "Now, now, Stephen, don't want Mitt overhearing." Mitt Hartley, chairman of the censorship committee, is chatting merrily away in a nearby cluster of golds, his face ruddy with wine. At mention of him, Dean Orthos only glowers more. "No, I don't. Tell me, Lee." He lowers his voice. "How do you feel about that man's committee?" From the way he inflects this, it's clear he believes I should have particular feelings about it because of my background. The censorship committee is a brainchild of Atreus, probably one of his least popular with the patricians. It has a habit of banning classical dragon tongue literature it finds to promote triarchist sympathies. Unfortunately, most classical dragon tongue literature seems to. I was more disposed to be forgiving toward Atreus's censorship practices before I learned he wanted me dead. But that doesn't make me any more disposed to discussing a literary heritage with this patrician bureaucrat, as if after 10 years of profiting off my family's massacre, he and I can get chummy over a shared love of dragon tongue literature. I flash a bright smile at Dean Orthos. "I gave up my heritage on Pytho's keep." Dora lets out a harumph of impatience. "Really, Stephen?" she says. Her voice, like Orthos's, is lowered. "What would you have instead, a free press? You've seen what the lower class metals print when given half a chance." It seems neither Dora nor the Dean, from his conceding grunt, has any sympathy for the Passy's leaflets and its full rations for all slogans. Of course, I realize with spiking anger, why should they? They might be opposed to Atreus's censorship practices, but they're very much benefiting from his rationing structure. They don't have sisters like Kors thanking them for smuggled cheese. Annie, who has been studying Orthos with eyes narrowed, clears her throat. "Dean Orthos, does your son work for General Holmes?" Orthos beams. "Why, yes. Lucian was just promoted to Chief of Staff." The bragging begins. I'm pretty sure I remember Lucian Orthos from classes audited at the War College. He was a few years up from us and a consistent ass. But the War Council is Annie's problem now, not mine. I make my escape. In the washroom, I splash cold water on my face. I look up, blinking droplets from my eyes, to find the man at the basin beside mine studying me in the mirror. Lisa Paller? I nod. The man extends a hand. I have to wipe mine on a handcloth before shaking it. Lo Tiran, he says. Lo Tiran, poet laureate of Callipolis, and Lotus's father. I've seen him before, at a distance, at the Lycian ball. He has Lotus's lanky frame and wiry hair. I hope you'll forgive my approaching without an introduction. I was hoping to ask. He starts talking about a poem he's writing. Commissioned by the Ministry of Propaganda, a revolutionary epic in the tradition of the Aurelian cycle, which was so unfortunately banned by the current regime, as I hope you'll... He fiddles with clover-shaped cufflinks as he speaks. I'm nodding along, barely listening as I try to calculate the best way to escape the washroom that was itself supposed to be an escape. When half a sentence he's saying gets through, hope to interview you about what really happened on Palace Day. I'm not sure how I get from the washroom to the alcove outside where Annie's waiting. She's in conversation with Power, a mystery I have no interest in exploring. I find a glass of wine has been pushed into my hand and down it. Sausage? I look down at the tray a server proffers, and it takes me a moment to understand what I'm looking at. In the middle of a rationing crisis, I'm being offered sausage wrapped in bacon and speared on a tiny silver fork.
Annie. I had not realized that this, moving through throngs of golds at Lee's side, could feel so much like riding Dragonback beside him. For the first time since he returned from the duel, I glimpse the Lee I know in the air, focused, decisive, ready for battle. To charm and laugh and shrug off moments of discomfort like a dragon snapping rainwater from its wings. This is the Lee I remember. The one who won't let a tapestry stop him, much less a few dozen tipsy golds. And though this exposure, private turned public, should make me feel vulnerable, standing at his side, smiling with all my teeth, I only feel powerful.